In this session, I'm going to look at the relationship between tax law and accounting practice. In general, the tax treatment of a particular item will follow the accounting treatment, i.e., income shown in the P&L account is taxable and expenses are deductible. This principle applies unless tax legislation or case law dictates otherwise. This principle has been around for years as the starting point for the measure of profit taxable as trade profit. However, recent legislative changes have actually made the accounting rules apply for tax purposes in many cases. In Finance Act 1993, the foreign exchange gains and losses rules for tax purposes were aligned with the accounting treatment. Finance Act 1994 required the recognition of gains and losses under the financial instruments rules to follow the accounting treatment. This was followed in Finance Act 1996, which applied the accounting treatment to all loan relationships for tax purposes. More recently, we have seen many changes in the rules to deal with the adoption of International Accounting Standards, IAS. The terminology used in statute has been amended to follow that used in IAS. For example, references to bad debt relief have been replaced with references to impairment losses. The government has gone virtually the whole way towards aligning tax and accounting in Section 46 of the Corporation Taxes Act 2009, which requires all accounts to be prepared using the true and fair basis. Section 46 of the Corporation Taxes Act 2009 removes many of the prescriptive rules relating to debits and credits for loan relationships and derivatives, replacing them with a general rule that the amounts to be taxed are those recognized in calculating the accounting profit and loss for the period. As the tax treatment in many cases is dictated by the accounting treatment, it is important to ensure the proper adoption of accounting standards. The tax treatment should follow generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP, as it is commonly shortened to. The need to follow GAAP has been developed both in legislation by Section 46 of the Corporation Taxes Act 2009 and in case law. For accounting periods beginning on or after the 1st of January 2005, the definition of GAAP is extended to include adherence with international accounting standards where required. In the case of Gallagher and Jones, a company entered into a 4-year finance lease, and let us say that the lease rentals are payable over this 4-year period. The rent actually paid was £397 in year one, and peppercorn rent for the remainder of the lease, which was the treatment which was adopted in the accounts. However, under SAP 21, the correct accounting treatment should recognize the economic reality of the transaction. The asset is being leased for a 4-year period at an overall cost of £400. So therefore, the correct accounting treatment is to recognize the cost evenly over the period of the lease as £100 per annum. The revenue disputed the accounting treatment. They put forward the view that there is no rule in tax law stating that expenses are deductible when they are paid, and effectively what the company was doing through the accounting treatment was to provide itself with a large upfront tax deduction to which the revenue objected. It was held in this case that the tax treatment should follow generally accepted accounting principles. Consequently, the revenue can successfully request that proper accounting principles are applied in the tax computations, even if the item is not material to the accounts. The decision in the Gallagher and Jones case reinforced the Revenue Statement of Practice 391, which requires the tax treatment of finance leased assets to follow correct accounting treatment. Generally accepted accounting principles are very important when it comes to calculating taxable profits. If the correct accounting principles have been followed, the revenue cannot dispute the treatment unless statute or case law states otherwise. This particular principle was established in the case of Johnson and Britannia Airways. Britannia Airways fly a fleet of aeroplanes. Britannia matched the cost of overhauling the jet engines to the actual flying hours the fleet had flown during the year. The revenue disputed this provision, basically saying it did not relate to the costs actually incurred, but to costs which had been theoretically incurred. They wanted the company to follow the accruals method of accounting by bringing forward an accrual from the previous year, accounting for the expenses actually incurred during the accounting period and accruing for expenditure committed to by the end of the year. However, in the judgment to this case, it was held that what Britannia was doing was perfectly acceptable under generally accepted accounting principles. The court did not follow the argument put forward by the revenue that something else might have been more acceptable. Therefore, the conclusion that we can draw from this case is where there is a choice as to how we apply a particular standard, the choice rests with the taxpaying company. We only need to prove what we have done is acceptable. It is not for the revenue to argue that something else might be more acceptable. Unfortunately, FRS 12 and IAS 37, which deal specifically with accounting provisions, has effectively prohibited a Britannia-style provision in the future, as Britannia would need to show they have a present obligation that is either contractual or legal before they can provide for the overhauling costs in this way. Let us now look at a case which provides us with general principles in this area. Herbert Smith is a solicitor's practice. They opened up office number 1 in central London and soon expanded their operations to a second site. They expanded again and opened up a third office, and expanded yet again and opened up a fourth office, all in central London. It was becoming logistically difficult to run the practice from 4 separate locations, and consequently, they made the decision to take out a lease on new, larger premises, Office 5, and moved everything under the same roof. All this happened back in December 1990, this date being very important for what was happening in the economy at the time. The leases on offices 1, 2, 3 and 4 were taken out by the firm in the heydays of the late 1980s, when land prices, particularly in central London, were very high, and therefore they had committed themselves to onerous rental payments. In December 1990, when they moved into Site 5, rental values on these properties had fallen considerably. As their landlords would not let them relinquish the leases, the only option that they had was to sublet the premises until the head leases expired. As a result of this subletting, losses in excess of £5.5 million would be created, and the firm provided for the full amount in the 1990 accounts. Naturally, seeing a provision as high as this, the revenue sought to disallow it. They quoted Statement of Practice 390, which basically says that we are not allowed to anticipate losses for tax purposes. Their argument was that the firm should have accrued for the rental losses over the period that the head leases expired. The firm disagreed, as they argued what they had done was consistent with the concept of prudence. SAP 2 specifically says that the prudence concept overrides the accruals concept. Consequently, when the case came before the High Court, the judge ruled in favour of the firm on the basis that they could prove what they had done was acceptable on accounting grounds. As a result, the revenue were forced to withdraw Statement of Practice 3, 1990. Let us now take a look at the principle of materiality. For accounting purposes, only material items are required to adhere to accounting standards. In other words, only items which affect the user's view of the accounts. The concept of materiality is not recognized by the revenue. For tax purposes, all the figures in the accounts must be examined, not just the material ones, as the failure to apply generally accepted accounting principles is likely to lead to an adjustment being required. For instance, let us say that we received the letter from the revenue asking us to confirm whether a particular provision meets the requirements of FRS 12. When we open up the audit file, we realize that we did not make any comments during the audit on this particular provision, as it is immaterial to the accounts. Unless we can put forward sufficient evidence to show that we have applied FRS 12 correctly, The revenue has every right to ask for an adjustment to be made in the tax computation. What about the relationship between GAAP and the FRISI? The revenue will accept FRISI accounts because the accounts submitted for that size of organisation have followed the correct accounting treatment. HMRC cannot insist that a non-FRISI standard is applied in a particular situation. A company may choose not to adopt FRISI, in other words, to adopt the full array of standards. The revenue's view on this is that if a company chooses to apply one particular standard which is not applicable to the FRISI, they must apply all of the other standards, and must do so in full. That is the revenue's view, which is yet to be challenged. Let us now look at the relationship between capital and revenue. HMRC believes that the accounting treatment of an item cannot change its nature, be it capital or revenue. This view is expressed in their bi-monthly publication, Tax Bulletin No. 39. Section 53 of the Corporation Taxes Act 2009 disallows capital expenditure unless it is mentioned elsewhere in the Corporation Taxes Act as being specifically allowable. Therefore, even if the correct accounting principles have been followed, HMRC can rely on separate statutory rules which disallow capital expenditure. The critical area for tax purposes is the recognition of income. There is currently no accounting standard dealing with the recognition of income for accounting, or indeed, therefore, tax purposes. However, where the revenue can show that generally accepted accounting principles have not been followed in recognising income in the accounts, they can successfully request the appropriate adjustment. This was given in the decision in the Gardner Mountain case. In this particular case, insurance commission agents sold policies and were entitled to an amount of commission which was paid to them at the time the policy was sold. However, if the policyholder cashed the policy in within the first 2 years, some of that commission may have to be refunded back to the insurance company. The insurance company, Gardner Mountain, advised all of their agents to account for the commission's income to the revenue as follows. 50% in the first year, 25% for the second year, and 25% in the third year. The argument was that at the time the commission is actually paid to the agents, there is a risk some of it will have to be refunded, for example if a policy is cancelled, and therefore it would be wrong to recognise all of the commission for tax purposes up front. However, the revenue successfully argued that this treatment did not accord with the underlying economic reality of the transaction. For tax purposes, the revenue were of the view that all of the commission should be brought into charge in the accounting period in which it is received, as it is this accounting period in which the work has been done to sell the policy. In the second and third years, the revenue would accept a deduction for any commissions which the agent subsequently has to refund, although in some situations a provision might be acceptable. Nowadays, we would need to follow FRS 12. Therefore, the revenue won the day on the fact that the tax treatment should follow the economic reality, which is effectively required by accounting standards. Finally, we need to give some thought to the impact of including IASs in GAAP. The main difference between IASs and UK GAAP is the tendency towards fair value accounting. IASs concentrate on balance sheet movements from the beginning and end of the accounting period. IASs provide for the recognition of anticipated profits and losses. Accruals and prudence still form the basis for accounting. However, there is a greater use of fair value accounting. Where there is a conflict, fair value will prevail over prudence. In amending the legislation to deal with IAS, in particular the loan relationship and derivative legislation, the revenue has given themselves the power to make regulations. Such regulations require amounts brought in when calculating the actual profit or loss to be left out of account for tax purposes. The regulations also deal with how these amounts are to be taxed. we will have to wait and see how the amounts brought in for tax will differ from those brought in under IAS. For accounting periods beginning on or after the 1st of January 2005, where in a group of companies one company uses IAS and another uses UK GAAP, if there are transactions between the two and a tax advantage would arise as a result of the different accounting policies, they are both to be treated as using UK GAAP. Deferred tax is an accounting term which does not impact on a company's tax liability. The aim of the rules on deferred tax is to recognise the impact of the difference in the accounting treatment and the taxation treatment of items. As we have seen, the amounts allowed for tax purposes are not always the same as those deducted in the accounts. To illustrate, let's say Catchy Limited buys a machine for £195,000 and charges depreciation of £13,000 in its accounts. In the tax computations, the capital allowances are £39,000. Catchy Limited is liable to corporation tax at the full rate of 28%. At some time in the future, this difference between the accounting deduction and the taxation deduction will reverse. In the accounts of Catchy Limited, there will be a deferred tax liability of £26,000 times 28%, which equals £7,280.